Portland.
KBOO Community Radio encourages all our listeners, whatever your political affiliation, to vote. October 27th is the last day to safely mail in your ballot. The last day to drop off your ballot at a Dropbox site is November 3rd by 8 p.m. If you have any difficulties getting to a ballot Dropbox, poll workers are providing ballot pickups. These resources and more information on voting can be found at kboo.fm/election resources.
Tune in on Election Day, November 3rd at 6 p.m. to hear KBOO's Election Night Special. We will start the evening with a live stream of Democracy Now! At 7:30, we will be tracking national, state, and local results live, as well as hearing from community groups and your favorite KBOO programmers as we break down this historic election. Again, that's KBOO's Election Night Special starting at 6 p.m. on November 3rd at 90.7 on your FM dial or online at kboo.fm.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than right now, and KBOO needs your help. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give or kboo.fm/donate. There's also a donate button on the website. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. We know times are hard. Many people are facing financial hardships, but every little bit helps. So donate whatever you can for the radio station you know and love online at kboo.fm/give. Help keep us on the air. If you're listening on the November 2nd air date, then you know tomorrow is your last day to vote if you haven't done that already, so get to a polling site early. You can find a polling site near you at vote.org and never think that your vote doesn't count. This is Wider Window Poetry. I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. This month, I don't have a live guest. Instead, we'll be celebrating the work of Elizabeth Woody, who served as Oregon's Poet Laureate from 2016 to 2018. But before I get to Elizabeth Woody, I'm going to read a couple of poems by Ada Limon. Ada Limon is the author of four books, including Bright Dead Things, 2015. She was a finalist. It was a finalist for the National Book Award and the National Books Critics Circle Award. She earned an MFA from New York University and is the recipient of fellowships from the New York Foundation for the Arts, Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center, and the Kentucky Foundation for Women. And her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Harvard Review, Pleiades, Barrow Street, and many others. Limon is on the faculty of the Queen's University of Charlotte Low Residency MFA program and the 24 Pearl Street online program for the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center. And I'm going to read two poems by her. The first one is titled, "The Contract Says We'd Like the Conversation to Be Bilingual." When you come, bring your brownness so we can be sure to please the funders. Will you check this box? We're applying for a grant. Do you have any poems that speak to troubled teens? Bilingual is best. Would you like to come to dinner with the patrons and sip Patron? Will you tell us the stories that make us uncomfortable but not complicit? Don't read the one where you are just like us, born to a greenhouse, garden. Don't tell us how you picked tomatoes and ate them in the dirt, watching vultures pick apart another bird's bones in the road. Tell us the one about your father stealing hubcaps after a colleague said that's what his kind did. Tell us how he came to the meeting wearing a poncho and tried to sell the man his hubcaps back. Don't mention your father was a teacher, spoke English, loved making beer, loved baseball. Tell us again about the poncho, the hubcaps, how he stole them, how he did the thing he was trying to prove he didn't do. That was the contract says we'd like the conversation to be bilingual by Ada Limón. Here's another poem by her. It's titled, How to Triumph Like a Girl. I like the lady horses best, how they made it all look easy. Like running 40 miles per hour is as fun as taking a nap or grass. I like their lady horse swagger after winning. Ears up, girls, ears up. But mainly, let's be honest, I like that they're ladies, as if this big dangerous animal is also a part of me. That somewhere inside the delicate skin of my body, there pumps an 8-pound female horse heart, giant with power, heavy with blood. Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to lift my shirt and see the huge beating genius machine that thinks, no, it knows it's going to come in first? That was How to Triumph Like a Girl by Ada Limón. Now I'm going to turn to Elizabeth Woody. Many of you are probably familiar with her work from her tenure as poet laureate. And I have a formal bio for her that I'm going to read in a few minutes. But to start with, I'm going to play part of a video that was produced by Oregon Public Broadcasting that will let Elizabeth introduce herself in her own words.
Warm Springs River. Daylight moves the wind while the river fastens on a cloak of rippling tensions. Through the weeds, sage blossoming, skin shivers from the distance of heat in the pinto sky, bright with expectations. Thirst has fingertips of grief over remnant scaffolds of small flowers. As one markless palm of thunder at the rim rock, the broad pulse of the body has been overwhelmed. A filament of light wavers on the liquid turn over lichenous stone. It sinks in its own gravity. It is a quick fin and tail. Well, the Warm Springs River goes from the mountains to Kaneda to the Deschutes River, and this place is a distinctive one in my childhood because the longhouse is here, the Hehe Butte Longhouse. As a child, I would spend time here looking at the rocks, looking at the spirals on the surface, the water skippers, the land is like my, as my uncle describes it, the long memory. You know, that it's what brought us our teachings. My name is Elizabeth Woody, and I am Navajo in Warm Springs and Yakima Nation. I'm born for the Bitterwater Clan. And you can see here my grandfather's mother. This is her beadwork, and she's posing with all of it. I like to introduce myself as my mother's people, or Wayampum, and Watlala, and Wasco. And my father is, you know, Totochini, and I'm also descendant of the Coyote Pass Clan. For me, I love to write. I love words. I love sounds. I love songs. I love stories.
In 2016, Governor Kate Brown appointed artist, educator, and award-winning writer Elizabeth Woody as Oregon's 8th Poet Laureate and the first Native American in the position.
The ancestors sing. This is not one voice, but the beginning of all voices in unison. Yes. Crescendo waves of spiral utterances of the plateau canyons. Blue herons rise from the river. The river returns pervasive with silver and red nusuch. I think my work is very much embedded in this landscape. Embedded in these times. I also think that my work as a poet laureate, well, anything that I do is always shaded by being a Native woman. She who watches, the names are prayer. For David So Happy, April 25th, 1925 to May 7th, 1991. My humanness is an embellished tongue. The bell, a yellow mouth of September's moon, beats outward. She speaks for all the names that clang in memorial. There is Celilo, dispossessed, the village of neglect and bad structure. The falls are faint rocks and rippled in the placid lake of backwaters. With a sad stone grief and wisdom, I overlook the railroad, the tight bands rail along the whirls of the Columbia. Drowning is a sensation fishermen and their wives know of. Men who fished, son after father. There are drownings in the dalles, hanging in jails, and off-reservation suicide towns. A strange land awaits the fishermen, as it had for the Nez Perce, the Navajo, the Cheyenne, those who wailed in the long walks, keened open the graves of their families, the dead children, my children, with names handed down and unused. Nimipu, Dene, Tzitzitzas, the people, pure in emergence. The immense mother is crying, human beings. The words are tremors in the ribcage of hills. The consumption of loneliness binds us. Children lie on the railroad tracks to die from the wail of night and spirits. I watch for the rushing head of chaos, and flat hands grope from the cattle cars, clamor in the swift, fresh air. A sky is clicking through the regular slats. The tail whips the dusty battles of the Indian Wars, unsettling itself, nude and raw. Celilo Falls sank unwillingly in the new trading, and everyone dissolved from the fall. I'm writing because I want to make my mother laugh, and I want my auntie to feel some sort of connection. I want my uncle's children to read my work and see things that I've seen that they may never see. Poetry is like ringing the bell. It goes, it keeps ringing. And sometimes there's experiences that are like that, that just keep ringing in you. And I'm able to put it into writing in a way that hopefully other people can feel it as well.
That was part of an episode produced by OPB in 2019 titled Elizabeth Woody, Transcending Chaos Through Art, and you can find it on OPB. So I'm going to read some biographical material here, which I've assembled from a variety of sources. Elizabeth Woody studied at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, earned a BA in the humanities from Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, just up the road here, and a master's in public administration from the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. Her collections of poetry include Hand into Stone, which has been reprinted as Seven Hands, Seven Hearts, and was a winner of the American Book Award, and also Luminaries of the Humble. And she also illustrated Sherman Alexie's poetry collection, Old Shirts and New Skins. Elizabeth Woody has a long record of public service. She served on the board of directors of Soapstone, and if you live in the Portland area, you should certainly be familiar with Soapstone. She's been asked to join the editorial advisory board of the Oregon Encyclopedia, that's out of Oregon Council for the Humanities. Advisory Board for Lewis and Clark College's Indigenous Ways of Knowing Project, and also the Willamette University Advisory Council for Native Programs. She was part of the steering committee for the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians proposed Northwest Indian Policy Center, and she's advised the Evergreen State College Native Arts Council's Native American Arts Fair. She received the William Stafford Memorial Prize for Poetry from the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association in 1994, and her other awards include the Hedgebrooks J.T. Stewart Award for Transformational Work and a Medicine Pathways for the Future Fellowship from Kellogg. I'm going to read a couple of poems by her. This one is titled Conversion. Changeable surface, sand, wind, brushes of grass. The composition of small particles and abalone shell is a mutable language, fluid and clean tonal lilting in attenuated motion. On the surface, removed from image, is an iridescent garment of compassion. Boulders are lapped in flow. Voices ascend to the lunar disk. Simple paintbrush bloom ecstatic in orange and red. Salmon pass through the river's mouth. Songs hum in the vocal throat of grace. Sagebrush around the loving fire waits in an aureole of pale courage. Hold still. Touch the compact smoldering soil. The flesh of salmon is translucent as flame. Heat and ardor, tender interior, smoke and calm weeds. The fire is a furious matter of watching. Familiar warm air rises as the red-tailed hawk, slow and loose, a pinpoint of vision on movement. Land uplifts the shadow higher. Sun raises the cottonwood branches from the river's surface. The salmon wait inside rippling light on the reversal of current. The song says, come or pass, be weak or strong, dance on light. Moon is in the color of pale belly's slow turn to sky. Scales illumine desire. Loosened moon particles collect on the fringe of grass and water. A brittle sheen of calcium and light combine with radiance. Fine combs of supple and rigid spines rest among the stone. The root, stone, flesh, and water. That was Conversion by Elizabeth Woody. Here's another poem, and this is from Luminaries of the Humble. It's titled Girlfriends. Filled with old lovers in the clutch of the chair, you are a bloom of uncombed hair. With a collection of roses, bowls of mashed petals, I make a clear cup of sky. Fold away clouds, roll up blankets of blue. I am a body of empty husks. Indian corn is in your hair, the tassels, the pollen, fertility. Indelible ink is tattooing our lungs. We speak smoke. We exchange our lunacy for reverence. Respect tornadoes. Windy woman, four winds. We have extended the edge of expectation by merely living. You have tallied compulsion into currency. I am measured by the excitement my lips stir. I am the bin for cast-offs and the weary. I wear my veil. I have no children, but you have many. You dream of heaven and they all run up to meet you. Girlfriends by Elizabeth Woody. I'm going to read one more poem of hers. This is titled Home and the Homeless. The buildings are worn. The trees are strong and ancient. They bend against the grid of electric lines. The windows are broken by the homeless and the cold past. I am home on the yard that spreads mint, pales the Victorian roses, takes into it the ravaged lilac tree. The black bulk of plastic lies about, stopping unwanted weeds for the landlord. Tattered, the cedar tree is chipped to dry heaps of recklessness. The unwanted spreads by the power of neglect. The wear of traffic says that we are out of time, must hurry. Age, the creak in the handmade screen door fades behind itself. Home and the Homeless. Now I'm going to play part of a talk that Elizabeth Woody gave in 2018 at the Lane Community College Longhouse. I'm not going to play the whole talk, but I'm going to include a welcome song that was performed for her by people at the Longhouse as part of the event, and also some poems, and then a short story.
I wanted to mention that as a formal, in a formal way, because upon restoration, Celeste was terminated upon restoration. One of the beautiful things that happened was that Warm Springs brought a song back to us. It was a song that was shared maybe at the Hop Harvest, but that's something I'm saying thank you. Liz is Warm Springs, and I'm remembering that Warm Springs people have benefited Celeste people in that specific way by bringing a song they first heard from Celeste people. They took it home. Celeste people forgot it, and then the Warm Springs people brought it back, and we're remembering that history. Is there more to say? I'm going to remember to give a shout out to the Office of Equity and Inclusion. Greg Evans, Vice President here, has contributed towards the travel costs that has incurred. A special thank you to the Language, Literature, Communications Division that is paying a modest stipend for Liz's appearance here. So shout out to Patrick Blaine, Dr. Patrick Blaine, and that division. This song is a song that is the Chinook canoe family song. It's sang usually at events of that nature. Tony Johnson wanted me to say hello to Liz and has given permission today for this song to be sung in recognition of Liz's visit. Liz is Wasco, among her other tribal affiliations, so there's a resonance with Chinook, a relationship we're remembering that way at this point. Is there more to say about the song? It's a Thunderbird song. It tells a story. There's a dance. We're not going to be doing it today. We'll just start with this song.
Thank you.
And in Twanat, Twanat means Nijishkin, to follow the ancestral ways, cultural life ways. Nimipu are the Nez Perce. Nusuk means salmon. And the Tule Reed longhouses are these really, it's like an extended teepee, like if you can think of an accordion teepee that has these tule mats around it. And if you don't know what tule mats are, they are one of the best insulators you can find in the world. And the tule mats in the summer would keep the lodges cool, and the winter would keep them warm. And of course, they were biodegradable. You could throw them in the river and they disappear. But the thing was, you could always collect them and make them into these mats. Twana. Blue moonlight and swooped clouds, thin to dark eagles mating in crosses of upward elliptical loops. Beating pulses, synchronized heartbeats among the tule reed longhouses. An old wound in the land, healed over years of corruption and charging horse soldiers. The children ran over the embankment. Alarms were frantic pounding of hooves and rifles. In the spirit silent rising and cracking bones, the valley courses with Nimi Pu souls. At times one hears music in the leaves. It is light and tinkles of shell, rapture. Runoff, torrents of moonlit ice. Exhale, breathe, deep Oregon pipes moan under the ribs from church. The ancestors sing despite conversion. This is not one voice, but the beginning of all voices in unison. Yes, crescendo waves of spiral utterances of the plateau canyons. Blue herons rise. The river returns pervasive with silver and red nusuk. In the late 1800s, of course, the Nez Perce were what was called the Nez Perce War, but it was basically the United States against the Nez Perce band of Chief Joseph's band, which were like 80% non-combatants. And they studied this war in what is that academy again? West Point Academy, as an example of really exceptional tactical genius, which is attributed in most history books to Joseph. But I think what we don't often realize is that when we succeed, it's because of many, not because of one. And Joseph was the peace chief. He had to make sure that the children lived, the elders lived, and the women lived, and that the horses and cattle and all of their things remained intact. And the war chiefs were Yellow Wolf, Aliquot, and I can't think of the other person, Pio Pio Mox Mox. And they were the ones who determined the strategy. And then the women had caches buried all over the Pacific Northwest that they had pre-buried in an event they needed an emergency like this, so that they could keep their people supplied with food. But also, they also knew the land very well and were able to outsmart the army and turn by turn. So that's what this is kind of about. And the other part of it is there are places on the land that people remember things. And they have a ceremony up at Fort Vancouver every year where they come in and remember the people who've gone and been lost in war. And they sing Yellow Wolf song as they come in. So it's a very beautiful song, and they ride in horse regalia. And then there are families who go to these places on that exodus to Canada to remember those who have fallen, because of course many died on the way, and particularly children, one being a cradle board left in the crook of a tree that a mother had placed there above sight so that no one would kill her baby, and then when she would come back when she was able to get it, because she figured she'd survive, but she didn't. This one is called Father. It is the language's desire. And my father wants me to learn Navajo, but I'm like, you know, almost 60. How is that going to happen? But I do remember being immersed in the language of Navajo. I do remember thinking that I thought in Navajo. And I realized that most of my early childhood with my father, and as my Uncle Louis, who didn't speak the language, told me, would spend days and days with me, and my dad would hold me, and they would pass a guitar between them and talk Navajo, and they'd pass me between them, and they would sing songs in English, which my uncle could sing, but then they would talk in Navajo. So anyway, that's neither here nor there. Father, security is found in the embrace of the language encoded in the child, rendered as daughter. In the blue air of twilight and at dawn, dirt and path rumble under a calming trot. The sky does not end so easily in the patter of the hard rain. You seem near,
The clinging wet hair is a cloak of absence. I know about water. It attracts the current by gravity and lightning by its elemental nature. This includes the grave thoughts of what protection is offered the assaulted. I am a fierce incarnation of your lineage. The black lace on the forehead and blanket's rough texture are not contradictions. I transpose the sound. It is the language's desire to move as the wind. Masculine genesis forces the water to rise up and fall as hard currents. As rain, awestruck by the sweet corn's thirst, the shirring wind of its tongues rattle incomprehensible words. Flight. Eagle hovers as a mobile cross. The blue clarity of tableau is critical detachment. It drops from vision a simple hunter. Afternoon hail, lightning and mist, light blue-gray years between birth and mother. Color-filled finches, morning doves, and canyon wrens sing. Smell sage, rolling back and forth between fingers. At the edge of juniper berries is the matter of prayer. The evergreen crests collect arches of pinon to mingle with ozone. Locate a circle of copper in a sliver of rock. A burning red draws eye to the circle. Palm open with hot lifeline, the rock fits along line path of light's shadow. Comfortable in small mounds of muscle. Our eagle plume stands up in the path. Breath moves on the brown edge of filmy down as divination of the proper direction. I had the good fortune of being able to go to Hedgebrook, which is up in Whidbey Island, and they offer residencies for like 1 to 2 months, some even longer, to people, and a lot of people apply to go there to do their writing. They're like, they call them professional residence artists, meaning they apply to all these residencies and spend all their year going from one to the other. And in this one, they give you a basket in the morning for your food, and then in the evening you go and eat dinner together, and then afterwards you share your work with the other women in that place, if you have anything. And they're from all over. When I was there, one woman was, you know, Korean, and the other woman was from New York. Anyway, this poem is about these women, and we're walking along and we're talking, and it's an excerpt. Between songbirds and crows. Here, crows are obsessive black pieces of past fires. Non-stop talking, pulling up all emergent sunflowers. A child yells in the distance, "Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!" She does not refine dialogue. She works in sound. Stop. Cawing is not idle work. Caw prettily. Cackles soft, throaty words. Please cover your beak when coughing. Polite, pretty birds are well cared for. Leap at the shoots of complacent sunflowers. Tomorrow's facade stares at difference. Authenticity singled from the rest, the best seed. While polite, the windy trees make jokes not to be ignored. Laugh until your ribs and back hurt. Learn Yoruba. Speak phrases in Manchurian. Sha, 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 shoo. Read 4,000 characters, perhaps Korean. Listen to Lushoot seed nightly as earth articulates excellence. Listen to the story. She traveled and learned to heal others while mending herself. She removes her clothes, giving them inside out. Who is speaking? Loquacious Calypso. She twists ribcage left and right, waving arms above, and a fringed voice, balmy, in an orange batik dress. She calls, llamas, pregnant goats, hushes the spaniels. I couldn't wear perfume, she comments. So open palms gesture to the fir needles, bits of pine cone that ornament her hair, small birds perch on a tree's crown. Oh, darling, where have you been? She speaks to the thumbnail lunar witness in the doe's orbit of spirit dog's chorus. With pleasures of other stories, lion claw of moon ignites celestial homes, poised in dreaming dusk, the arousal of Mars. So I think that's, oh, one more, it's not too long on that section. Relatives. The round dance sprinkles a cut bead glimmer over the grass. The straight and rounded shoulders glide the circular path with a sawing motion of fringes. While making her dress, the woman slid the scissors into the cloth to cut the pattern of clouds for the lightest transparent blue underdress. She talks in succinct interludes to her companion. Her smile radiates into the offered handshakes. These intervals influence the design on her yoke and her mind. Creation is now occurring. The animals dance in the connection. The island body emerges like the turtle with clay exposed from the deepest indigo. Gratitude wings darkened light, the musical cadence of chaos in the space of composure. Water twirls over cliff's edge. Spray feels velvet without weight of fabric on lifting steps. Symmetrical voices merge, echo, abundance, all life, my relations. The flat teeth of the morning sun chew at the blisters of the old tar-papered house. In the garden that thrives under a cloak of sagging cheesecloth, the grasshoppers pose on the promise of a meal. Grandma is framed in the kitchen window as the tongues of curtains remain out from the morning breeze, even with the hollyhock's colorful bonnets uptight against the wall. The house can appear as barren as a piano without ivory. There is a swarm of colors around about the screen door of calicos, tabbies, sylvesters, and blackies. They mew for their meal in a chorus. As I turn back the covers from my floor bed, I hear humming and a spoon scratching the sides of a pan. Watching the swill of leftovers sop up the milk, Grandma turns to take the pan to the cats, 20-some wild ones. She is pleased to see me up so early and smiles a toothless greeting. Hi, honey, got to feed my livestock. She sings her good morning almost in the sweet, high-voiced, rhythmic dialect of Warm Springs English that sounds Indian. She is no bigger than 5 feet and no more than 80 pounds. I see her hook the cats in her path expertly with her toes to flip them aside with a dancer's grace. Once I had balked at Grandpa's joke about putting up little goalposts in the yard for Grandma to improve her cat punting. That was some years ago. Now I'm oblivious to her harmless way of walking through the fur mass of cats that stay for the one meal and all the mice and grasshoppers they can eat in the garden. As I settle at the table, I think of the music my grandmother makes, which evokes some aspect of the world I had forgotten since my last visit, like toads slurping up great moss at night, or the ripple and tumble of water over the rocks in the river. That is how her songs sound to me. I breathe in the sweet smell of old age that lingers after my mother's mother. The Nivea, the cleanliness of air-dried cotton, the oiled hair. I noticed two plump rainbow trout on the counter and moved to clean them. She returns quietly upon seeing me work, tells me, "You can fry up those fish. Someone brought them over real early. One relative I don't know at all. All these kids look like strangers to me. I guess it's just old age that makes me forget how many of all you kids there are." She laughs a little as she looks to my response and out of her eye corners, sit behind her coffee at the table. "Oh, Grandma," I say, and catching her mood, tease back. "I know you have to remember me, if not for my family resemblance, then just for the trouble you had to take to wind me so you could catch me and make me come inside from playing." I eye her likewise with cornered eyes. I see her catch her coffee in her lips in an effort to keep from spitting the liquid out and laughing. That would encourage me. She responds quickly, saying, "Your mother could outrun me." Usually she ends this comment about my mother's great speed in childhood by saying she was just too tired to whip her for her naughtiness. Listening to the house groan in the ceiling, Grandma changes the subject to the building of our ranch house up Tenino Valley. "Your grandfather's people made that old ranch house over there, all from one tree. All the people came to do what they could, pound the nails, split the wood. The woman butchered and barbecued the steers. Everyone helped then. They drug the tree there by horse team. Those days, our people knew how to do everything for themselves, not like nowadays, where we have to hire big shots to come in and boss us around." The pan snaps from the wet skin of the fish as I begin to fry them up. I know that she did not witness the building of this ranch house. She has only merged her stories with my grandfather's emerging they wanted, symbolized by the two cedar trees they both planted side by side when they married, saying to each other that these trees would grow together like they would, intermingling their roots and branches as one, while still letting the winds of life blow between them. I say, to bring her back to the moment, "These are pretty trout, Grandma. About as good as the ones we used to catch. You know, the ones that would make Grandpa so mad." Grandma reaches up to arrange the folds of her navy blue Western bandana on her head. It is folded, tri-cornered, and knotted on top. She tilts her chin upward. "Oh, how he would get mad. He always said I had more luck than sense. I had a good dream about him last night, that he and I and Baby were fishing. Baby and I caught a fish, and then we were jumping up and down around it, squealing. Grandpa said we were scaring away his fish. He always wanted the fish to just jump on his hook." I laugh. "Grandma, I must have been that baby. Sometimes I wish that we had some poles so we could fish. But then we never did learn how to tie a good knot for the hooks. Oh, and how we chased those grasshoppers for bait. You laughed so hard at me, jumping as hard as the bugs. We just had to sit down in the cheatgrass and hold our sides and our dresses up to our legs so the grasshoppers wouldn't jump on them. But what really got Grandpa was the fish we caught, that you would just flip them up in the air behind us. He said that was no way to treat a fish." Grandma, nodding her head, continues the reminiscence. "We only used a pinhook and bait. He had to spend our money on the fancy lures, the steelhead poles. He had his science and some notion that he treated the fish better when he made some big game out of it. We just needed our fish for the table, not for bragging. Your grandpa was a good man, even though he had a soft heart about killing things, like the deer." The heat intensifies outside and the hut bugs sing their legs into a zing without pause. Grandma sips her coffee, intermittently stirs the spoon in her cup. She eyes the spiral and begins to dream like she dreams during the day between words. These stories of old days are magical. I'm gullible and young enough to still believe in magic. The magic in the soft rumble of blood life, laughter, our great heart under the land. I hear that great tree and the cedars breathe through the house too on occasion. Up the valley, I can see the mountain hold a cap of a cloud. That mountain is as storied as our lives. We walked, lived, and lusted after a young woman mountain. He walked and lived and lusted after a young woman mountain. Fought with Waist for her a time way before the changer came to have all this chaos beat it up into some monstrously big dreamer design. The design I only sense from the perspective of a bead. Sometimes I dream of this. I see segments of this power hanging from the hands of old ladies as they dance at gatherings. When I told my boyfriend this, he said I was too way out for him. That's how he seems to be anymore, despite all the singing, sweating. He's too heavy with war and struggle to see the story. Yet, love always seems to knock men down, to drag them back to these houses of magic, just like love knocks us down and pulls us out to the sticks, to follow that guy, keep an eye on him, just in case something might take him away by terrible magic. Yes, the age of the changer has passed, but the bloodline is still with us, and the inspiring thread of women's labor, the beads, the great transformer, and the talk of love. The beautiful woman in earth still whispers into the ears of her children. Oh, witch, I holler as the grease sizzles on the skin of my hand. The fish get one last bite on me. Watch your cooking. You might get as bad as I was. I never got the hang of cooking on electric stoves. I always cooked on some wood stove or campfire. The first days I was married to your grandfather, we lived in a tent to put his brother through college, you know. Yeah, Graham, I don't think it was your cooking abilities I inherited, but this old dreamer brain. I wasn't thinking about the fish in the pan. At this point, she chuckles deeply, nodding her head, which turns her bandana a nudge worth out of place. A meadowlark tinkles a song from the yard. She tilts her head so her bandana looks correct and says, he sings about the rain that will come soon. Of course, in Indian, he makes his song. That is why it is so beautiful to me. She taps her finger on the handle of her eternal coffee cup. She waits as she always waits in a meditation. She waits through her chores. She waits for her children to come and visit as I visit, answering her call for company. As I pull out the enamel shallow bowl dishes, I remain quiet so as not to interrupt her the thoughts I see about her, probably a prayer. She responds to me out of courtesy, and since her thoughts linger over her long life and the memories that are so necessary, I again think about the music I hear. I hear songs in my dreams, which is unusual since I do not know any songs or even know Indian. I think of it as this: the music comes from the tapping of her finger, beating out the occasional soft song, the way a river sounds while we fish, and the sound of the life, dragonflies whirring by, singing to me. The music mingles and makes these songs that sound through my dreams. Maybe I catch the hum of the mountain over there, too. He's waiting, you see, to get involved with that fiery young woman he sees at the corner of his eyes. Mountain love is a real shaky, fired-up affair. They push up great hilly ranges, bed over the lakes, rub up against one another so wildly that it takes years to cover up all that passionate rumbling and love talk. Once my grandmother said that her great-great-grandmother and aunt had to run their horses into a lake and cover themselves with wet hides to keep from getting burned. The water was so hot, it took all their courage to stay put. I believe that was the last rumble before the mountain curled up for a good sleep. When I told one of my science teachers about this, he said that these stories are just myth, not fact, and that mountains don't love or even erupt anymore. I believed him until Mount St. Helens erupted. It erased all innocent belief in the fable of absolutes in science for me. Thank goodness I had heard some fact about those mountains way before I entered school. I gave my grandmother her share of the fish, and she says, as she always says, "Oh, honey, that is too much. Put some back. I'm not company." "Eat, Grandma. We have plenty for many lifetimes over." I settle my body down to savor the fish. "You know, I'm sure miss Grandpa, and I miss his whistling in the mornings when you and him would cook together. You remember that?" She retorts, "I have spent half of my life cooking for all of you. But it was your grandfather who could cook the best. He knew all the dishes of this and that, just like he knew all that wild music, high wine, I think it was called. He was a great jokester. You'd tell a tale, you'd tell a story as tall as he could, but I thought you hung around him too much." I smiled and say, "You both were pretty wild examples for me to follow. I think a lot about how you two would play in the kitchen while you cooked what you called a farmer's breakfast. The potatoes, ham steak, eggs. Between flipping over the food, you would dance to Western music on the transistor radio, the jitterbug, the Charleston. Yeah, I remember how you two carried on while you thought I was still asleep." I smile thinking of how agile Grandma was, dancing, diaper pins on her dress, blue tennis shoes toeing in and out, Grandpa twirling her around in his sleeveless white undershirt, pants always neatly belted, with a wide smile of pleasure, watching Grandma's face spin like a light in the early dawn. Grandpa had a grin so wide it would go halfway around his head, especially when he had Grandma going or had her aggravated from teasing. Then he'd grin all the more while he sweet-talked his way back into her good humor. It seemed like that you two always end up dancing with a good fight, boxing with your dukes curled over. You always won with your Appalachian apple cut, half a wind up and a quick strike to Grandpa's glass jaw. Then you'd grab his pants seat and you'd have him at your mercy. He'd say, "I give up, honey, I give up, I'll marry you." We both laughed a great laugh at the memory. Grandma tucked the trout meat into a pooch in her soft cheek, tilted her chin toward me, and said in a quiet, matter-of-fact tone, "Your grandfather didn't marry me for my home cooking. I thought you always knew that."
This has been Wider Window Poetry, KBOO 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland. As always, thank you for listening, and stay safe out there. Thank you.
KBOO Portland.
In the 1980s, Portland, Oregon was a sleepy city that largely existed outside of the national spotlight.
Downtown Portland cleared out after 5 p.m. and city buses rolled through quiet streets populated by hobos, punks, drunks, drug dealers, and street kids.